Hello and welcome to The Addicted Austenite, your one-stop podcast for all things Jane Austen. I'm Catherine, and today Jane Austen is sharing the spotlight with another famous female author, because I'm still talking about the major historical events that were going on during Jane's lifetime. And today I'm talking about the publication of A Vindication on the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft. Now, Mary Wollstonecraft, she is a woman who deserves an entire podcast to herself. In fact, I'm sure there are some out there, so if you're interested, go and seek them out. Or if there aren't any, create them yourself. For this podcast, though, I'm just going to be doing an episode on her. So we're going to have a brief biography, and then we're going to talk specifically about one of her, well, the most famous book she ever wrote, A Vindication on the Rights of Women. Like Jane Austen, Mary Wollstonecraft had an unfortunately short life, but boy did she pack a lot into it. Some basic info first. Mary was born in 1759, and she was the second of seven children to her parents. So like Jane Austen, she had a very big family, though they're at opposite ends of their respective families, being second oldest and second youngest, respectively. Unfortunately, Mary's childhood was nowhere near as smooth as Jane's. Mary's father in particular was, well, to be honest, he was a nasty piece of work. He squandered the family fortune, forcing Mary to make withdrawals of money that would have been hers for inheritance, so the family suffered financially. But he was also a very violent man, and he at least used to beat their mother. Mary writes later on about having to stand in front of her mother's doorway to stop her father from getting to her mother. So it was a very traumatic childhood that poor Mary had. She was a very strong member of her family, was Mary. Being the second oldest, she did mother a lot of her younger siblings, particularly her younger sisters. She had quite a few. There were five more children after her. And being thrust into this domestic role so early, Mary gained skills that she would then use to branch out on her own and join the working classes. The first jobs that she ever had before she decided to become an author were jobs like governessing and ladies' companion and so forth. So it's all about the domestic life. First of all, in 1778, she becomes the lady's companion to a woman called Sarah Dawson, who lived in Bath. She left that position to come back home to care for her mother in 1780, and unfortunately her mother did die. Once her mother was gone and Mary didn't have to care for her anymore, she moved in with a family friend called Frances Blood and her family, and sort of joined their domestic team, as it were. She lived with them and helped out around the house. Sadly, Fanny died in 1785, and Mary was forced to move on again. She moves in with a family called the Kingsburghs, and she becomes their governess. It's during this role that Mary decides that she's had enough and she wants to become an author. She spent her whole life seeing how women are badly treated and neglected and devalued by society. And she says, that is enough. I am fed up. I am going to branch out on my own, and I'm going to write about my experiences, about the experiences of women, and we're going to change things. So Mary packs her bags and she moves to London, and she does actually manage to support herself. I know it sounds horrible to sound incredulous about that, but you have to remember that women's roles were so, so much worse than they are today, that it was unthinkable that a woman could make a living as an author, especially an unmarried one with no husband to support her. But Mary did it. She got a couple of different jobs. She mostly wrote reviews of novels and other books, and she also worked as a translator. So she learned French and German, and she started to translate French and German works into English. Mary met a lot of interesting people while she was in London, as you can imagine. It really was a hub of philosophy and writing and social change. And one person that she meets in particular that has a big impact on her life was a man, an artist called Henry Fuseli. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. And they like each other and they actually pursue a relationship, even though Henry is actually already married. Sadly, I suppose at least for Mary, the relationship doesn't work out. Mary tries to suggest to Henry and his wife that they have some kind of platonic living arrangement, but of course Henry's wife is having none of it, and Henry himself rejects Mary and broke off the relationship. Mary is heartbroken and humiliated by this, and she decides that she's had enough of living in England. She is going to move to France. And France in particular, because she's been watching the events of the French Revolution unfold. She is slap bang in the middle of it right now, as we talked about when we were looking at our episode on the French Revolution. So she's actually really interested in the revolution, in its beliefs, in its reasons, and she decides that she wants to be a part of it, and she moves to France. She had written by this point something called Vindication on the Rights of Men, which was in response to a critique of the French Revolution. So she's really into the ideals of the revolution, and she thinks that France is the perfect place to go. Unfortunately, France doesn't quite work out in the way that Mary hoped. It wasn't as accepting a place for her in particular because of the circle of people that she moved in. She arrived in France about a month before the king was guillotined, and she was stuck in France for the duration of the Reign of Terror. And she saw her friends not only arrested but executed as well as part of the Reign of Terror. She tried to escape a few times. She tried to get to Switzerland, but she was denied access to Switzerland. The thing that saved her, really, was a friend of hers. She meets a man called Gilbert Imlay, and they begin a romantic relationship. They don't get married, but they are very intimate. And it's really Imlay that stops her from being executed during the French Revolution, because he lies. He's an American man living in France, and he lies to the US embassy, and he tells them that he and Mary have gotten married, which makes her an American citizen, and thereby she can't be touched by the Reign of Terror. They have to go through the US embassy to get to her, basically. But however horrible life under the Jacobins was for Mary, and how difficult it was, she still continues to forge ahead in her career as a writer and trailblazer. She does, during this time, write The Vindication on the Rights of Women in 1792, and in 1794 she gives birth to a daughter who she calls Fanny. As far as anybody else was concerned, Mary would always tell people that Fanny was a legitimate child, that she had married Imlay, and that Fanny was legitimate. Of course she wasn't, because the marriage was a lie. But Mary called herself Mrs. Imlay, and to save her child from prejudice and censure, she full-heartedly stands by the idea that her daughter is legitimate. But unfortunately, the relationship with Imlay does not last. He moves back to London. He moves away. Mary stays in France for a little bit, but then she decides that she's going to go back to England and see him again, try and rekindle things and get back to the good relationship that they had Unfortunately, when Mary does go to him in 1795, Imlay rejects her, and it's horrible for Mary. She is distraught at his rejection of her. And it's during this time, sadly, that Mary tries to take her life twice. These attempts do not succeed. Both times she is saved from what she's trying to do to herself. I don't want to go into the particulars of what happened. Talking about suicide attempts is one of the things that I find very difficult to talk about. So I've mentioned it because it is an important part of her life, that she did attempt suicide twice, but I'm not going to go into detail. So if you want to find out the details, then I would suggest that you look it up for yourself. After these attempts, it takes a while, but gradually Mary begins to return to her old life, and she starts to write again, and she becomes involved with a literary circle in London. And among that group was a man called William Godwin. Godwin and Mary had an interesting relationship. They had met in London before, but they didn't like each other very much. They always argued and were always opposed to each other in any argument. But this somewhat, should we say, unique relationship does develop into something a lot more passionate, and they do become lovers. Mary gets pregnant by Godwin and they decide to marry. They get married in 1797. It does cause a bit of a stir because by marrying Godwin, Mary reveals that she was never actually married to Imlay in the first place. Remember when he lied to save her in France? She had been saying all that time that she had been married to him and that it was a legitimate marriage, but the ease with which she's able to marry Godwin shows that it was a sham marriage. So there's some whisperings about that, but the couple are happy. Then we fast forward about 5 months after the marriage, after the wedding, and Mary goes into labour with her second child. And the child is born, it's another daughter whom she names Mary. And this young girl would grow up to become Mary Shelley, author of Frankenstein. Unfortunately, the labour causes problems for Mary Senior. The placenta breaks and Mary gets an infection. And unfortunately, several days later, Mary dies from septicemia. It's a really tragic end to Mary's life. She dies at the mere age of 38. Like Jane, her flame is snuffed out far before its time. But her legacy endures, and her writing and her activism have inspired so many people throughout the centuries since her works were published. And in particular, A Vindication on the Rights of Woman is lauded as a feminist manifesto, if you like. It's one of the first feminist writings in Britain in this period. There have been a few before, but this one made a really big impact. Sadly, we don't know if Jane Austen ever did read of The Vindication. There aren't any mentions of it in her letters, and none of her characters talk about it. And sadly, it hasn't been found in the Austen's family library either. So we can't be certain whether or not Jane read it. But the themes in The Vindication really match up with a lot of Jane's own ideals and the things that she discusses in her novels. So I think it's really interesting to look at this book in particular, to explore the feminist context around Jane's novels. There are some who would refer to this period of female writing as proto-feminism rather than just straight-up feminism, because, well, at least the word feminism doesn't exist at this point. It's not until later that it becomes a named thing and an idea with, again, a name and a purpose. However, personally, I think it's a bit unfair to say that people like Mary and Jane weren't just straight up feminists rather than proto-feminists, because there are so many layers to feminism and so many degrees of it that while, yes, they did perhaps overlook certain elements of the female experience, you do have to look at these things in context, and it is unfair to judge them from today's feminism standards. But that's just a personal thing. Let's get on with having a look at The Vindication. To give it its full name, A Vindication on the Rights of Woman with Strictures on Political and Moral Subjects was published in 1792, and Mary writes it as an argument against the people in society who think that women do not deserve to be educated. Female education is what she primarily deals with within this work. She is talking about how women are just as important to society. They deserve the same rights that men have, and in particular, they deserve rights to education. And to express this, Mary expands upon a few main themes, and hopefully some of them will sound similar to you in the context of Jane Austen novels. So the main themes that everybody finds in the book are rational education, feminism, sensibility, republicanism, and class structure. As I said, hopefully some of those themes sound familiar, but I am going to go through them one by one and talk about what we see in the book. The first theme that we mentioned was rational education, and what that means is an education basically in men's subjects. So during this era, men and women's education was split. Men went and studied maths and science and history and all sorts of other intense academic subjects like philosophy and theology, whereas women's education was more geared towards home life and this example of an accomplished woman, which we do find, of course, in Pride and Prejudice. So women's education is more about sewing and music and languages and entertaining and being a good domestic woman. What Mary is arguing for in this book is that women deserve, just as much as men do, to learn the academic subjects as well. She argues that women have just as much to give as men do on these subjects, if only they were given the chance. The second theme, feminism, is a little bit more complicated. As I said, there's no real feminist movement during this time. It isn't named as such. But what Mary is talking about in this book is about the changing role of women and the rights that women deserve. And if that's not feminism, then I don't know what is. And it's a similar branch of feminism that we find in Jane's novels. Jane's novels are all about the new woman, the changing role of women, and the way that women are coming forward in society. All of her heroines are these new women with new ideas and new sensibilities that are getting ready to change the world. The third theme, sensibility, hopefully has some pretty obvious connections to Jane Austen. I have done a whole episode about the idea and the cult of sensibility and how it relates to sense and sensibility. In A Vindication on the Rights of Woman, Mary is talking about how women are seen as irrational creatures with excessive sensibility, and they're only feeling, they're not capable of rational thought. And she is saying, hang on a second, that's utter rubbish. There is a place for feeling in everybody, but to say that one gender is particularly affected by it, prone to it, or ruled by it is completely unfair. It's an interesting theme that Mary explores as well, because she does start to talk about relationships, love and marriage, and even sex. She explores the idea that women shouldn't be slaves to their desire and to male desire either. This is perhaps the most controversial part of the book, because she is tearing into the foundations of the institution of marriage, which is such a big thing in Georgian Britain and is what a lot of girls at the time do live for. As we see in Jane's novels, there's this obsession with marrying well, because it's the only thing that can secure a woman in life in this era. But what Mary is talking about is how women can be so much more than their feelings and their desires, and the feelings and desires that men have for them. Mary's fourth theme in The Vindication, as I mentioned, was republicanism. Now, this doesn't refer to republicanism as we know it today as that political party in the States. This is bare bones republicanism about the ideals of a republic. And in the book, Mary is talking about republicanism with regards to the French Revolution and what she's seen there, and the morality of republicanism versus, for example, a monarchy. She does argue, for example, that there shouldn't be titles and there shouldn't even be a monarchy, that everybody should be represented in a government, which at the time are some pretty radical ideas. And I really do have to applaud her bravery for putting her opinions out there. In the times that she lives in, this is almost akin to heresy, you know, and that she goes out and she proudly exclaims what she thinks about these things is just so inspiring and amazing. And the final theme that she gives her solid opinions about in this book is class and class structure, which hopefully you'll recognise as a major part of Jane Austen's novels too. Now, it could be argued that this part of the book isn't necessarily as radical as the other ideas. Mary does attack the wealthy in The Vindication, but that doesn't necessarily mean that she has sympathy for the poor, for example. Mary is very much a middle-class writer at this point. She has known a certain amount of poverty from her family, but they have always, in many ways, like Jane and her family, managed to survive, and they are part of that middle class. And Mary does call the middle class sort of the most natural state in society, but that doesn't mean that her critique of the upper classes should be ignored or are worth any less. And it is very much the same kind of class critique that we see in Jane Austen's novels. They both focus on the class structure of the middle and upper classes. As I've mentioned before, we've talked about class in British society in previous episodes, that Jane doesn't put the working classes and the lower classes into her books. She's writing about the position that she's in, which makes sense, you know, write what you know. So the class structures that Mary and Jane are both critiquing are the way that the wealthy deal with the middle classes, which, although perhaps doesn't describe the everyday struggle of everyday people in Georgian Britain, but it is an important argument, especially in Georgian Britain, where everything is changing so rapidly and so forcefully. We've talked before about new money versus old money and the mingling of and blurring of class lines and how people's places in society are viewed. So although neither woman is fighting for the rights of every class in Georgian Britain society, given the context of their era, it is still so brave and so amazing that they're even critiquing the class structure that they are. And I don't believe that their achievements in that field should be overlooked. So there we are. That is Mary Wollstonecraft and A Vindication on the Rights of Woman. Hopefully, through the course of this episode, I've been able to show you the importance of Mary's work, and in particular that piece of writing, and how, although Jane may not have read that book in particular, we can see how important the book was in terms of female thinking during this era. Let's not forget that the book is being published just as Jane is starting to write her main novels. She's working on the early drafts of Northanger Abbey, Sense and Sensibility, and Pride and Prejudice when this book is published. And the book did have a lot of success. There's this odd view that it didn't do very well contemporaneously, but it did. People did read it and people talked about it. So although we don't know for sure that Jane read it, I think it is really important that we talk about it as part of the context and historical context of Jane's novels. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Addicted Austenite. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have, please do like and subscribe and all those lovely things. I will see you next time for a new episode, and until then, as ever, happy reading. Your faithful servant, the author.